I think we'll start. Jane, you ready?
Yes. Okay. Thank you, Sue. Good morning, everybody, and welcome to this session on rate-regulated activities, agenda paper number 8. I just want to do a very short introduction. I appreciate there's a lot of information to get through, but I just want to make a little clarification on some of the papers. And to really emphasise that when we're looking at the model, we're looking to account just for the adjustments that are summarised in paragraph 14 of paper 8A. And those adjustments reflect the temporary timing differences that arise when, according to the terms and conditions of the regulatory agreement, the amounts billed to customers during the period don't fully reflect the goods or services delivered during that same period. The timing of the billing is established through the rate setting mechanism, which reflects the rate regulator's objectives that are described in paragraph 13 of paper 8A, including the objectives to improve the stability of pricing and the predictability of pricing for customers, and also to spread the cost of the regulatory requirements or the satisfaction of those regulatory requirements across different classes and generations of customers, which may then spread that cost over different periods. Consequently, the adjustments that we're looking to account for in the model don't represent a general right to increase or a general obligation to decrease the rate that's applicable to goods or services that are to be delivered in the future. Instead, the adjustments relate to a capture of the amounts that relate to the goods and services that have already been delivered. And the adjustment mechanism is used by the regulator to determine the cash flows, the billings to customers. Perhaps it's easiest to see this more clearly using the examples, and just very briefly I'll take you into example 1 in paper 8B. And you'll see there at paragraph 23, that highlights that the regulatory agreement gives entity W the right to charge a regulated rate to customers that's intended to cover the actual input costs incurred for the chemicals used in the water treatment. During the first year, 20X1, entity W incurs a cost of $32,000 relating to the delivery of the water services during 20X1. And according to the terms and conditions of the agreement then, the entity is entitled to charge customers $32,000 for the goods and services delivered during 20X1. However, by the end of 20X1, the entity has only billed $30,000 out of that $32,000 entitlement. So at the end of 20X1, the entity is still entitled to send further bills out of $2,000. But instead of sending to customers an extra invoice for that $2,000, the entity waits until it's sending future bills out for the services delivered during 20X2 and adds on the catch-up amount from 20X1. So when we're talking about the favourable rate and we're using the term favourable rate during 20X2, what we mean by that is the rate that the entity is entitled to charge for the services delivered in 20X2 is only the $30,000, which represents the cost of the services delivered during 20X2. However, the entity in X2 charges or bills $32,000, so the favourable amount of $2,000 isn't relating to the services that are being delivered during X2. That's the catch-up from 20X1. So hopefully that kind of clears up perhaps some confusion as to what we mean by that favourable rate. And with that, I'll just then remind you that there are questions in the cover note, but I know that the two papers interact quite a lot, so I'm not going to ask you to restrict yourselves to talking about things individually, and I'll just open up the floor then for any questions or comments. Alexandra?
Answering the first question, do you agree with the accounting proposal here? Yes, within the jurisdiction, agree completely. By the way, thank you very much. It's a very good job here, very extensive and very difficult topic to go through. The question is, let's put a small variation, example one here, is assume that the company has this right to charge a little bit more for a customer, but there is no demand at the end of the day. At the end of the day, there is no demand for that, because of course prices increases and something like electricity, there is no demand. And the company, and actually the government gives the company the right, the company are entitled to financial compensation for that, which means to get a certain amount for it. Do you believe in that case that you fit in this framework here, or be classified as something like a financial instrument or in that case?
I think with that one, Alexandro, it really depends on the facts and circumstances, and you do need to look carefully at whatever agreement perhaps the government has given you.
For example, you have 3 years to charge an extra amount for electricity bill, for example, can increase by 20%, but because the demand has collapsed, the company is the utility company is not going to be compensated.
Yeah.
So the government say, well, in that case, after 3 years, I give you a certain lump sum amount of X. The question is, this X amount here, if you include that in this framework, it will be accrued over the period. As long as I see the demand is not coming, I will start to accrue that as a revenue here, as if it was a price mechanism working. But instead of a price mechanism, there is a, that's called a lump sum mechanism, accruing that. The other view, you know, that this is a financial instrument. After 3 years that you have entitled to it, you get a financial instrument against the government, like a public note or things like that.
That's different to the basic assumptions we're working with, though, isn't it?
So it is might not be quite different, but
it's different to the basic assumptions that we really want to discuss, I think. Yeah. Yes.
I mean, it's something that we'll need to consider in due course with the interaction of the model with other IFRS standards. And what we're saying at the moment is we're trying to make this apply first and then, make other standards apply first. So if you've got a financial instrument which takes precedence.
I don't know if it's a financial instrument, okay? Just asking, I'm just saying that.
That's sort of why I'm being difficult, because I don't really want us to opine on whether it meets the definition of a financial instrument on the fly.
I think the challenge with what we're dealing with here is that there are three parties essentially to the agreement. I think the way you're describing what you're describing is actually it's a more conventional bipartite agreement. Mm. So there's a direct agreement between the entity and the regulator that the regulator will compensate the entity in cash money for something. So I think that does take it outside of the scope of what we're talking about.
It will compensate exactly the way it's described in the example here. Only if that doesn't work.
But it's adding something on. But
it's adding something on.
It's just different to our base case that we're discussing today, I think. I think it's still a relevant question, but I'd prefer to park it if I could, just because it's not really covered directly by the papers. Doesn't mean at some point we're not going to come back to it, but I'd just prefer
but
to do it on the fly.
If I may ask, it is really very important in our jurisdiction to have that situation covered, because it's a common situation.
Yeah, definitely.
Right? Yep. So we're going to can I ask you what I do now?
So but can we be clear, though, because it might not be the regulator.
Yeah.
Maybe the government.
Maybe the government, yes.
Because the government, in our jurisdiction, appoints the regulator. So you just need to consider the totality.
Yeah.
Okay. No, and it's fair. So we need to remember to come back to that. Sang Soo?
Thank you. I'd like to question you about the paragraph 26 in the example one. I'm curious about why do you mention that the entity W cannot control whether its customers will buy water service in the future. Actually, we think we don't have to see if the entity controls whether its individual customers will buy in the future. We think in perspective of the customer base, that is the collective customers, if it is explainable that the entity W can control the receivables from customers as a whole, because it is very unlikely that the customers as a whole will not buy water services in the future under the defined rate regulation. and the receivables from customer space will be recovered or collected in the future when the customers as a whole will buy water services, which is just a way to collect the receivables. That's our opinion.
I agree totally with that. The fact that we can't control the individual customers doesn't negate the fact that we've got a right to recover these amounts. And in these examples, again, we've simplified it to take away demand risk, to say that, yes, the customers collectively are big enough, and because we're in an environment where there is little opportunity for customers to go to competitors or to stop using the services, collectively there's a very, very high probability that we are actually going to get the cash flows ultimately.
I guess what I wanted to outline, a couple of concerns that we have with this, and then I guess our suggestion on how you might take it forward to address those concerns. Now, as we've said in the past, that our view of the rate regulatory agreement is an intangible asset. We understand why you're not going down the intangible asset route and not recognising it. It is very problematic, and certainly understand that and not suggesting that you should. But our analysis of it, when you look at the regulatory agreement in particular, the entitlement to the earn this target rate of return, because ultimately that's a key part of the regulatory agreement, that the regulator wants to ensure that on the one hand you're not ripping your customers off by putting that up mm-hmm. too high, given you are in this environment where it's difficult for customers to go elsewhere and it's often an essential public service. But on the other hand, you want to ensure the economic viability of the entity so it can continue. So the regulator's there to essentially deal with both of those objectives and set the return to achieve that. And then certain transactions or events can occur during a particular period, which means that your actual return could be higher or lower than the target return, and the rate adjustment mechanism is a way then of adjusting it so that you earn less or more in future periods to accept the great higher or lower returns you had in the current period, so that over time sort of averages out to the target that it's trying to achieve. And it takes into account not only your revenues but your direct costs, but all your PP&E and all sorts of things that you have to do in order to deliver those goods and services. So it's essentially a way of adjusting your profit to get this overall fair return. And we see essentially the regulatory the balances that arise out of that rate adjustment mechanism as increases and decreases in that unrecognised intangible asset. And therefore, when we look at the analysis here, in the past we've talked about how we see, particularly if you were saying that these things are individually assets or liabilities, probably the asset size not quite so bad, because having gone down the route, so we can't recognise the whole asset for very good reasons. Let's see if we can do some pieces of it. Recognising a piece as an asset for a bigger asset, that's not quite so bad because you're on the right side of the ledger. But it's where you're characterising what we see as a decrease in an unrecognised asset as a liability conceptually. We can understand there might be reasons why you want to do that practically, and I'll come back to that later. Conceptually, that's a concern because we don't consider it does meet the definition of a liability. And looking at this analysis to see, does that change my mind? Looking through this, and I did actually think long and hard about did it actually change my mind? And I guess I found it interesting that the analysis started with the discussion on the revised framework about executive contracts, because that starts out by explaining there's a right and there's an obligation in an executive contract, but the individual right and obligation don't themselves meet the definitions of assets and liabilities because they're interrelated and can't be separated, and therefore it's the combined contract that's the asset or liability. And I think what that tells us, just because you can construct sentences that have the words right and obligation in them, and the definitions of assets and liabilities have got right and obligation, that doesn't necessarily mean every right and obligation in any particular arrangement meets those definitions. And so then I ask myself, okay, looking at turning to this scenario, the rights and obligations you're describing, can I see them as being separable distinct standalone rights and obligations under those. And when I did look at what, how you're describing favourable and unfavourable, I still feel what you're actually doing when you're looking at the executive contract. So we know what that means in, say, in the financial instruments, that's an interest rate swap. Where the pay leg is higher than the receive leg, we know that when you're settling net or gross, there's going to be a net outflow of resources to settle, and that's why you end up with a liability in that situation. And then when I looked at what you were comparing here, you were comparing the regulatory adjustment is causing your return in the future to be higher or lower, and if it's higher, it's favourable, if it's lower, it's unfavourable, comparing to the base case in the regulatory agreement. So to me, you're comparing one part of the regulatory agreement with another part of the regulatory agreement and saying that's how we get to this higher or lower. And so that's why I keep coming back to, I think, they're interrelated, and therefore you still are talking about increases and decreases in an unrecognised asset, and that's why we still have this concern around the liability side. And of course, in the framework project, we have expressed concerns about the liability definition and is it clear what all that means. And I think this kind of reinforces it, because you're obviously comfortable in your minds that you have constructed an argument that gets you to this is a distinct liability as distinct from the regulatory agreement itself, and it is a valid liability as opposed to the way that we analyse it as being a decrease in an unrecognised asset, which brings me to my second concern, that essentially the contagion effect, that if we have these kind of what we see as constructed arguments to get to the outcomes, and I understand why you're trying to get to the outcomes in this particular arrangement, it's all done for a good cause, it's not just, you know, theoretical thinking because you've got nothing better to do. It's all come to the good cause, and that good cause is the concern that the current accounting is not necessarily showing the complete story in the performance statement, that if you just report on what actually happened during the period and you have earned a greater or lower return, and you know as a consequence of that in the future you're going to have to earn less or more, that is that potentially incomplete and misleading to users of the accounts, because they may just look at it and say, oh great, you've done really well, but not realising actually as a consequence of that you're going to not earn as much in the future. And so that's why you're trying to recognise these very selective pieces and not other pieces. So for example, if the regulator reviewed the actual rate of return that you were looking for and said, now you can earn more, maybe we've been a bit hard on you and we think in the future you should be able to earn more, giving you a right to increase the price and earn more, or the other way around, you wouldn't want that to be brought into this analysis, because that's not a particular piece you're trying to capture in order to deal with the problem. And I suppose why we're so concerned about it is the contagion effect, that if people start using this type of thinking elsewhere, now in practice you may be able to ring fence it, you may be able to have something in bright shining lights in the standard that says this applies in the context of the transactions within the scope of the standard, it's a highly specialised area, do not apply this thinking anywhere else. I mean, you could do that to stop people trying to mount these arguments, because when you start thinking about people using these arguments outside of rate-regulated or defined rate regulation, then it clearly could be problematic. So that might solve the practice issue of ring fencing it and being very clear you don't use it elsewhere. But I guess there's also an ongoing standard-setting contagion effect, that once you start constructing these arguments to suit outcomes in particular projects, as projects go on, I think it will become very unclear what assets and liabilities are, and particularly the liability side, if the board were ever to revise IAS 37, when you, in that context of that project, you can't actually have a highly constructed argument that works in a very defined set of facts and circumstances. It has to be a generally applicable argument in order to make sure it works. But then by the time you get to that, which might be years down the track, in the meantime all these standards have been created that said this is an asset or this is a liability, and we no longer know what they are anymore, which I don't think is the purpose of the element. So getting to the solution, our preferred solution would be that you come back to the broader objective of financial reporting around providing useful information. The concern that if we just apply the definition of elements strictly, and we know that those elements aren't perfect, and they're never going to get everything that we want them to get. But the reason for having them there in the first place is to provide us with some consistency and some coherence, and then then you could say, well, the concern is around the incompleteness of the performance statement. That's why we're recognising these regulatory balances. I'd even be comfortable if the basis said, some argue there is, that these do meet the definitions of assets and liabilities. Some argue they're not. So at least allowing for that, that there are different views around that, particularly because this is the first project in which you're seeking to use those new definitions. I think that you need to be really, really comfortable that this is indeed an appropriate analysis more generally in order to say that that's what you want to do and really get back to providing useful information, which I would analogise to the IFRS 10 investment entity exemption, because if you look at the definitions of assets and substance over form, you could say by not consolidating you're missing some assets. However, the key reason for doing that exemption was to provide useful information because investors said that's what they wanted to do, which I think is appropriate because ultimately that the objective is where we want to get to. So appreciate I'm coming at it a different way than you're coming at it, but nevertheless that continues to be our view.
Thank you. Jim?
It might be explained slightly different than the basis in the US, but I think the end result is very similar to our regulatory framework or our accounting framework for rate regulation. I take the concerns about contagion effect. Our standard has existed for 30 plus years. I don't think it's had a significant contagion effect in practice and people trying to analogize that where there isn't defined rate regulation. And I don't think it's had a significant contagion effect in accounting standards of uncertainty of whether somebody's in a rate regulated environment and similar. And again, maybe the articulation is a little more crisp in terms of how it aligns with the framework than our basis. And of course, the frameworks have both undergone change since then. But I actually found the arguments to be in line with how I would have viewed the framework, appreciating that others could view that differently. But I think when you break it into a tripartite agreement, I find that compelling, at least in my mind. The one question I had on your questions in considering the characteristics of the defined rate regulation was, and it's in paragraph 5A, that it's binding on both parties. And then I think the example in paragraph 9 talks about the rate regulator cannot terminate the agreement with W unless W persistently fails. And I question, at least when the government is the counterparty, whether or not that is realistic. I guess binding in the fact that there is a rate compact, but certainly governments can do what governments do. And so I would be cautious in terms of how you might word that, no different than, for example, deferred taxes. We recognize assets. The government's the counterparty. The government can change the rate, including, to zero, at least in theory. Now, politically, there's some less flexibility, but certainly when the government's the counterparty, what does binding mean in that context?
Keith.
Darrell, do you want to come in? Even though you're masquerading as Tom, just because you've got the same surname.
This is upright. There you go. I think possibly it was just to ask a question of Kimberly, just to make sure I'd understood correctly, and it sort of kicks on a little bit to what you were saying. I wasn't 100% sure whether what you were saying was that you think these are assets and liabilities, but that they represent a class of assets and liabilities that we historically have not recognized, and the contagion effect is we might start to recognize more, or whether you're saying you don't think these are assets and liabilities at all, and the contagion effect is that we might recognize other non-assets and liabilities.
Yeah, it was the latter. I think that there is a bigger asset, which is in the regulatory agreement, and these pieces that you're wanting to recognize, we see are increases and decreases in the unrecognized assets, and we think because of the interrelationship between that the pieces you are recognising and the pieces you're not recognising, that they are interrelated and they only exist. So the ability, to, for example, to earn more if you've got a regulatory balance that's positive amount, or more specifically, if you've got to earn less in the next period because something that's happened is actually a decrease in that unrecognised asset. And that's a concern, that we don't think that they are pieces that can exist independently of the unrecognised piece, which is a similar idea to an executive contract where you say the right and the obligation have to be combined because they can't be separated and they're interdependent. We think there are interdependencies between the pieces you're wanting to separate out and the unrecognised piece, and that's why, particularly on the liability side, we think it's a concern because we don't think it's, from a conceptual perspective, we don't think it's correct.
It's because the liability is actually a negative asset.
It's a negative asset, that's right. Yeah.
Cedric?
Thank you, sir. Well, in France, we have discussed with some entities that may be concerned by the by regulated activities, and they are very supportive of that project. So we really encourage the support to continue in the direction. We particularly appreciate maybe three main issues that have been discussed today. The first one is the introduction of the customer base, even if it's not more discussed that way in the paper. We understand that it's still in discussion. Maybe it would be interesting to understand why it's not mentioned anymore in the paper, because we think that customer base may help in change of unit of account, may help to go beyond the difficulties of recognizing unknown revenue and contradicting IFRS 15 or recognize some liabilities that we have forget to recognize to date. So I think that specificity may help in going beyond the current dilemma that we have with right and obligations.
On that, my understanding is the spirit of the customer base is still there, but Jane found it so difficult to control the board members of the discussions that she's taken the words out.
And it goes back to Cynthia's point that, you know, we're looking at collectively the customers are such a powerful body.
That's what we understand also. The second point is that we appreciate also the focus made on the representation of performance and in the PNL, and that's why also we are a bit struggling with the debate on assets and liability. Maybe it should not be a prerequisite for the continuation of the project, because they are, and especially whether such assets and liabilities comply with the current or previous conceptual framework, since there are some standards dealing with deferred assets or deferred revenue, such as IS12, IS20, which do not comply with the standard already. And maybe the depiction of that performance may, what is important is to find a counterpart in the balance sheet. Maybe it's neither an asset or a liability, maybe it's equity like under IFRS 2 if we want to better represent the performance. So I don't know what is the solution, but probably what is for us very important is to have a better representation of the performance in such business. And finally, the fact that we deal that in a separate standard, like an overlay, I think it makes sense, especially with what Alessandro said previously. We have some situation in France also where there is in the agreement a part which is dealt through the with the revenue, but also maybe with a subsidy of the state. So you first have to apply IS20 and so on before contemplating whether you have to add another layer of adjustment. So it makes sense. Just to finish my point, the three points where we think there is still a very important discussion to have. The first one is on the scope and a clarification of some concepts, especially in regard of other standards like, not really standards, but IFRIC 12 or IS 20 could probably make sense and help. And also in order to identify what is rate-regulated activity and what is not, we try to collect the views of the main constituents that may be concerned, We think we have them, but it depends on their activity also. So we'd like to make sure, even if the scope would be then reduced, maybe it's better to have clarified concept on that area. Second point is on the uncertainties, which is linked to such contracts. It's a very important matter because in some areas we may have an agreement, but it may not be immediately enforceable. So there may be a negotiation in between in order to apply correctly that agreement. So that the best estimate is difficult, maybe difficult to assess, and then maybe it could be interesting to consider whether how to deal with such uncertainty. Is it a matter of recognizing it differently, just mentioning in the notes, that may be also an area. And finally, on the classification in the PNL. Our understanding is that in the objective of such regulation is to provide a return on for the provider on which is a mix between revenue and cost, which is providing a margin actually. So probably it may be disclosed with IFRS 15 revenue, but it's not, and therefore. There could be other ways to analyze that margin and disclose it elsewhere in the P&L.
Yeah. We did chicken out completely on that argument by just putting it as a separate line between revenue and costs in the examples, because that it's exactly it could be a hybrid type of adjustment.
Françoise does remind us at regular intervals that we might need to think about what is in there.
We continue to discuss this. I think most people that we're talking to now are reasonably happy with the overall approach you're taking. Some really don't care whether they're assets or liabilities. Others accept the analysis that they are assets and liabilities. And some are still trying to convince themselves that they're assets and liabilities. In the discussion, concerns were raised over control, concerns were raised over what's the past event if you've got to sell more in order to make this revenue adjustment. And the one that really interested me and I'd never thought of before was the person who said, in the framework, if there is an asset, there is a presumed to be a liability. Now, we normally think about this as utilities and customer bases and hundreds, thousands of customers. But what if it's just the distribution network and there's two customers? Would you expect those customers to recognize their share of the opposite of the asset or liability? I haven't thought through the answer, but I thought it's a really interesting question. Because logically, if the company is going to have to pay back money, and you can identify the people who are likely to receive it, you would logically expect them to recognize an asset. So I have no conclusions on that, but let me throw it into your mix. Then I think when it comes to the examples, everybody sees them as a pretty logical development of where we've got to. So the issue becomes now, we think it's about time for the ISB to actually be discussing this from a realistic perspective. Question one is scope. When we talk about it, we all think things like utilities, and we've got a lot of mental overlays like the government is part of the regulator or sets up the regulator. If we mean that, we're still not saying it. So I think scoping is going to be a really, really difficult issue. How do you distinguish between the government utility that's promised on average you will be profitable, but I don't have an adjustment schedule, to the one who says, here is how the adjustment schedule works, when both are over time getting to the same result? And the other thing is we now need to start looking at realistic examples. So for some of these arrangements, maybe it's a five-year agreement, and the fix is in the following 5 years. So you've got uncertainty, You've got time value of money. Is the regulated entity compensated for not getting this money for some period of time, or is there in fact a discount element? So they just need to be explored. And of course, we're at the moment, for simplicity, assuming a zero margin. Well, in many cases, that's not realistic. We did a bit of talking around on this P&L justification, and we have two very clear solutions for you. Preparers want revenue to be the regulated revenue, never mind the IFRS 15 revenue, and users want the revenue to be the IFRS 15 revenue and the adjustment to be provided separately. So I think it's very clear what the right answer is, and I'm glad you're able to work it out. Thank you.
Thanks, Patricia.
Thanks. Well, I guess I've come a long way personally on this in this project, because I certainly started off, I think, very much saying, and I don't think that there's separate assets and separate liabilities. So I think what certainly did it for me for this project was the IFRS 15 approach. And as I've mentioned before, I think I would have liked a pure IFRS 15 approach to be applied. And by that I mean the rate regulation is effectively part of your consideration with the contract with the customer, and that gives rise to, you know, variable consideration. So, you know, in your example, in the first year, it was initially estimated that this would be the consideration, and it's based on these costs. And then when those costs are finally determined, it turns out that those costs were higher. So in terms of the contract, you know, you're saying to the customer, well, you know, we've now determined what those costs are, and the agreement was that you would compensate us for those costs. So the consideration is now, you know, is now higher or lower, whichever way it's going to go. So as I really like that approach, and I think that to me that gives a very nice conceptual basis for this. So very much supportive of. And I think it's got to be emphasized, the whole customer base as a whole, because as soon as you're looking at individual customers, then that argument starts to weaken. So definitely looking at the customer base as a whole, and that must be, say, strengthened. And then, say, while I, you know, really like the, as I'm calling it, my pure IFRS 15 approach, I appreciate that that's not where we're going to land. But then I start to reconcile where I'd like to land with where you're landing, and I think in terms of the end result, other than maybe presentation, which we'll come to, I think that we're landing on, you know, on the same or very similar positions. And I liked your opening today, because, and I do think that what you were saying today, I would say, is not really coming through in the paper. I was concerned when I read the paper that there was an emphasis now on saying, in the future, for future services, I can now charge more, or in respect of future services, I must now charge less. And those were giving rise to assets and liabilities. And there, if I put a conceptual hat on, I struggle, I think like Kimberly, to see that those in their own are assets and liabilities. And I appreciate that, you know, obviously we're looking here at regulated environment, but, you know, I was thinking of in a non-regulated environment, if in a particular jurisdiction, if the exchange rate has weakened, and as a result the suppliers, you know, haven't recovered all of their costs in that year, well, they may all be increasing their prices next year, and they've all got the right, I mean, in a free market, to increase their prices and to charge the higher price. But, you know, and I think that's where I share the concern about contagion, to say, well, as a result of that, you know, I've now got an asset because I get to charge more next year for my future services. I don't like that approach. So I certainly like the approach which is saying, as you described in your opening, as saying in this first year, we estimated 30,000, and that's how much the rate was based on. But we actually incurred 32,000. So had we known that, we should be charging, or we would have charged 32,000, and therefore it is an adjustment in respect to the services already provided, and that the manner in which we're going to recover that is simply by, you know, charging a higher rate. But I think we've got to be careful that we're not linking it to future services, otherwise I struggle to then see the asset and liability. So for me, even though we are applying IFRS 15 pure first without the rate regulation, and then we're doing this as a little bit of an overlay, I still think that overall we need to try and still stick to the IFRS 15 principles, because then I think it gets you a nice conceptual argument for why you do have an asset and a liability, as you would in IFRS 15 if you've not charge the full amount, but the customer is obliged to pay, and vice versa. So for me, I still think that just needs some perhaps better articulation so that we can, you know, hang our hats on the conceptual definition. And then just regarding the presentation, as I said, I guess for me, I'd like it as close to the revenue line as possible. But I think for me, if you're saying in your example then that if you only charge 30,000 the first year and you see that as your IFRS 15 revenue, then you see somewhere else this other 2,000 coming through, and then next year your IFRS 15 revenue, all things being equal, is going to be so much higher, and then you're going to have an expense coming through somewhere. And I suppose the question is as well, you know, what is that expense now? So, you know, I would certainly say that I'd like to see us call it then the IFRS 15 revenue, and then as close as possible to that, this adjustment, be it positive or negative, to give you to sort of like a net revenue, if you like. To me, I think that would be the most useful.
Okay, thank you. Thanks. Sorry. Peter?
I'd like to comment on, I guess, three aspects. First of all, the assets and liabilities. Secondly, Patricia's comment about whether there's a counterparty who has a liability. And thirdly, this customer base question. And they're all linked, I think. So I think the first point is the regulatory agreement creates a whole package of rights and obligations. And in agenda paper 8A, we split them into two components. One component we call the base component, which in fact is sort of everything else. And section B is this adjustment mechanism. And it's the adjustment mechanism that we're particularly interested in because it has different properties from everything that's in what we've called there the base component. And what's different about that component is that something happens and it creates these originating differences, and then the originating differences reverse in a relatively predictable manner. And that's not the case for the rights and all the other rights and obligations that we've lumped together in what we call the base component. Now, the conceptual framework talks about rights and obligations, and it talks a bit about units of account. And of course, as you all know, we're not able to give a definitive answer to the units of account that we can sort of apply across the board and say this is going to be the units of account in all situations. So I don't think you can say that individual rights and obligations don't necessarily meet the definitions of assets and liabilities. I think individually they can. You have to look at them each on their own merits. But there's also a unit of account question, whether you're going to account for them all in one package, when you account for them together, when you account for them separately. And the view we came to was that it was worth accounting for the things in the adjustment mechanism separately because the way they operate, the pattern is so different because of this origination and reversal effect. And another important point of that is that they also operate pretty much independently of the other component, the other rights and obligations as well. So if we pull them out, it doesn't actually affect anything really in what's left in the other component. Of course, it's much more problematic when you have interactions with components, and we've We've seen that all the time in the debate about embedded derivatives, for example. That can become very artificial sometimes when you take those out because of interactions. But in this case, at least in the simplest examples, we don't see significant interactions. Where there are significant interactions, we'll have to think about that later on, and that will probably affect the scoping to some extent. So we've not seen these as increases or decreases in the overall package of rights and obligations. We've seen them as a subset of the rights and obligations we've pulled out as a separate unit of account and accounting for separately because of this different property they have. The different property they have, probably one of the main drivers for that is the effect on the performance statement. But that's not to say that we're trying to engineer an answer and create artificial assets and liabilities to get to a predetermined answer in the performance statement. It's because they are rights and obligations. We do think they meet the definition of assets and liabilities. We think they're worth accounting for as a separate unit of account because of this separate pattern. And one of the big drivers for that is because of the effect on the performance statement. But it's not sort of reverse engineering. On Patricia's example, where she says if the entity has an asset, does somebody else have a corresponding liability? And I think it's a good and legitimate question. But I think the important thing is the right we're looking at is not a receivable. We're not talking about a receivable from the individual customers or even from the customer base. But it's a right to adjust your price solely because of something that's happened in the past and because the adjustment mechanism lets you adjust your price because of that. Without the adjustment mechanism, you wouldn't have the right to adjust that price. And if that specific event hadn't occurred, you also wouldn't have the right to increase the price. And the asset we're accounting for is the right to adjust the price. It's not a receivable from somebody else or some group of other people. The third thing I wanted to mention was the customer base example, because that was in some earlier versions of this analysis for the board. The board got quite confused about it, and I think the reason we took it out was because actually you don't really need it. I think if you were seeing the asset as some kind of receivable, then it might make sense to think in terms of customer base. And in fact, I've heard similar notions discussed in the insurance world in participating contracts, where people talk about the sort of community of policyholders. But I think if your analysis is that it's a right to increase to charge an increased price or an obligation to charge a decreased price in the future, then you don't need the notion of customer base, because the right is the right, the obligation is the right, and the right or obligation is vis-a-vis the regulator. It's not vis-a-vis the customers. It's because the regulatory agreement gives you rights and obligations.
Linda. Thanks. So it won't surprise anyone that we are in agreement with the staff's position and we're supportive. But to elaborate a bit, so first of all, from an asset and liability perspective, I would say that Peter has very eloquently articulated what our views would be, and we would be supportive of that. And we also concur with the notion of reflecting the activities in the performance statement appropriately. And our user base has been very clear with us. Of course, they're used to seeing the impact of regulation in the statements, but they're very clear with us that this is important to them and it should be in the performance statement. So we would support that. From a presentation perspective, what we're actually having some discussions right now, but we think it makes sense, rather than lumping everything together in one line item, that what you might want to consider is having an area yet to be defined where you group revenue-like items and cost-like items. So you give some clarity on how the balances are being reflected in performance in that particular period. And so we're going to explore that a bit more, Jane, just to take it forward. Okay. Yeah. So in general, we are appreciative of the fact in terms of how this is progressing and the transparency which the discussions are taking place. And so we continue to be supportive. And in general, in terms of telling the broader group, we have made enhancements to our research paper based on contributions that people have given us. I said it last time, I'll say it again, we're still open for business. So if you have more to add to it, just let us know. We will give you an update on the status of the paper as soon as we get a chance to take another look at it. The board looked at it. about a month or so ago gave the staff some direction in terms of articulating in the paper more clearly some of the points, just to make sure that we're being completely transparent, but there will be an update to that paper.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you. We don't have major concerns about the examples in the paper, but as Cedric and Patricia mentioned, I think we think that scope and uncertainty will be a significant challenge for the ISP in the future, and we look forward to following the ISP's discussions.
Sven and Francoise both had their cards up and then put them down. And we've still got a few minutes, so was there something you wanted to say? I was going to come back to you. So.
Sven has to live. our comments were very much in line with the two, so more realistic
example. Okay. Francoise, did you want to add anything?
Well, I mean, I put it down because I thought I should take some further thought of the subject, but I was not expecting Peter's view on the fact that the counterparty to the rights or the obligation would not be the customer base. And I think it is the customer base, and that doesn't make the asset a receivable. But I really regard these assets and liabilities as very similar to the contract asset and the contract liabilities that we have in IFRS 15. And that's the way I look at it. So to me, the counterparty is the customer base.
And I almost said, so I'm pleased you said that actually, Francoise, because I almost said, Peter, when you said that, that I wasn't sure that all of the board members actually agreed with that. So that might be where the staff's at. There might be some catch-up.
Yes, can I just add to that, that even if Peter's right is correct, I'm trying to get my language here, that the right is not a receivable, but it's a right to charge, then under the framework, shouldn't there be a counterparty that has an obligation to pay more? If you could identify who it is there any reason why they shouldn't be recognising that? I don't think it gets away from the primary point that it may be possible to identify the counterparty, and in that case, would you expect them to recognise it?
I think maybe if I could come with this and I go back to the diagram that we've got in paragraph 11. And I appreciate lots of people struggle when we haven't got this two-party relationship, we've got the three-party. What we've tried to demonstrate in that and why we're moving towards the keeping the IFRS 15 revenue number is when we're looking at it from the other party's point of view, we're struggling to get the connection between the past transaction and event in the same way that we do for the company. So because the company is looking outwards and looking at the customer base, they can see they've got a right or an obligation to the collective customers. But when you're looking at it from the other side, in the contract from an individual customer back to the company, what you've paid for is what you've received during that period. The fact that the price is made up of different elements from that side of it, I think isn't relevant. You have paid the price that you've committed to pay for the services that you've received this year. And if you're not receiving the services next year, you don't suffer the unfavourable rate or benefit from the favourable rate. So that's how I see that we're not in a position, and I'm answering this kind of, you know, without giving it further thought, which obviously we'll need to do. But my initial reaction is that, again, it's that two different ways of looking at it. From an individual customer, you're looking at it from your individual perspective. From the entity, you're looking at the collective customers.
Jim?
That's how I would look at it. I think if you had financial reporting for that broader group, that societally there is an obligation to pay a higher rate than you otherwise, you know, you've had costs that you have not passed on to society, which is, I think, exactly why we have rate regulation.
Thankfully, they're it's not either, a reporting entity.
Yeah, there's no entity there, but I think if that thing was an entity, you might say there's a liability.
Were there some comments from China that you wanted to share?
Well, China's generally not been supportive of the model, and they still feel the model reflects the differences between the estimated and the actual amounts, and that it may still not provide useful information to users of financial statements.
Okay, thank you. I guess what I should say at this point, and especially in response to the examples, were very simplistic and they need to become more realistic. We totally understand that. We wanted to make them simplistic to try and get through the basic principles. We are going to go to the July board meeting. We've already finalise the papers for that, but we are going to look a little bit more at some of these issues that we've talked about today and look at the role of uncertainty in terms of the assets and liabilities that we're trying to recognise. So we will try and make sure that if it's not already included in the paper, we'll reflect your comments to the board as part of those discussions.
Okay, so
do you want to mention World Standard Setters?
So we've been working on the agenda. I think it's actually on the website now for World Standard Setters. So there'll be two large case studies. One will be FICE and the other one will be rate regulation. So we'll be building off on the illustrative example.
We'll bring tougher examples than we want.
We're looking for